In the third year of abundance, Ephraim came into the world. The maiden mother would not even look at him at first, and the mother-in-law was more out of temper than ever. But Joseph quite calmly gave him the name that meant, "God has made me to grow in the land of my banishment." He might well say so. He drove in his light car, accompanied by runners, acclaimed by Menphe's people in his name of Adon, to and fro between the splendid residence presided over by Mai Sakme and his offices in the center of the city, where 300 clerks were at work, and gathered in stores until there was an abundance almost beyond keeping account of. He was a great man, the universal friend of a great king, Amenhotep IV, who by that time, to the furious chagrin of the Temple of Karnak, had put aside his Amun name and taken on that of Ikhnaton. It is pleasing to Aton. He was also playing with the idea of leaving Thebes altogether and building himself a city dedicated entirely to Aton, where he thought to reside. Pharaoh, of course, wanted to see his shadow dispenser of the teaching as often as possible to discuss with him about above and below. Likewise, it could not fail to happen that Joseph, in pursuance of his great office, traveled several times in the year by land or water to Noet Amun to make report to Hor in the palace, when the two of them would spend hours in intimate talk. And Pharaoh, too, on every trip to Golden On, or when he drove forth to look for a proper site for his new city, the City of the Horizon, would stop at Menphe and stay with Joseph. This, of course, put a heavy burden upon Mai Sakme, though he never faltered in his perfect poise. The friendship between the frail descendant of the pyramid builders and Jacob's son, the foundations for which had been laid in the Cretan loggia, grew with the years into a warm and intimate bond. Young Pharaoh called Joseph his little uncle, and when he embraced him, slapped him on the back. For this god was an enthusiast for informality, and it was Joseph who, out of native reserve, kept the balance in their relations. The king often laughed at the formality which his friend preserved in the midst of their familiar intercourse. They talked of their ill luck as fathers, that the one got only daughters, the other only sons. But the dissatisfaction of Joseph's wife and her nagging mother did little to dampen his joy in the grandsons of Jacob, who were growing up in the strange worldly world so far away from their grandsire. Equally, the failure of a male heir could never depress Pharaoh's buoyant spirits for long at a time. Everything was going so wonderfully well in the maternal kingdom of the Black Earth that his reputation as the teacher of the fatherly light was strengthened mightily thereby, and he might sit in the shade of prosperity, giving witness to the god on whom his soul hung, and in speech, as in solitude, expending all his parts to think him better and better forth. Debating thus, defining and comparing the high and holy properties of Pharaoh's father, Aton, they might remind us of the religio-diplomatic exchanges which took place at Salem between Abram and Melchizedek, the priest of El Elyon, the highest and also the only god, exchanges which ended in the agreement that this El was just the same, or pretty much the same, as Abram's god. It was noticeable, however, that it was always at the point where the discussion seemed to be approaching such an agreement that the courtly reserve which Joseph preserved in his relations with his exalted friend came out most plainly. Chapter 5. Tamar. The Fourth. A woman sat at the feet of Jacob the rich in tales, in the grove of Mamre at Hebron the city, or close by, in the land of Canaan. Often she sat at his feet, either in the house of Hair, near the entrance, on the very spot where once the father had talked with his darling and been beguiled of the many-colored coat, or else beneath the tree of enlightenment, or at the marge of the well close by, where first we met the subtle lad beneath the moon and watched the father go peering after him, leaning on his staff. How is it the woman sits with him now, in this place or that, her face lifted to his, and hearkens to his words? Whence comes she, this grave young creature so often found at his feet? And what sort of woman is she? Her name was Tamar, We look round at the faces of our hearers and see on but few, only here and there, the light of knowledge. Clearly, the great majority of those who are here to learn the precise circumstances of this story do not recall, perhaps do not even know, the bare facts. We might be disposed to censure, did not the common ignorance jump with the advantage of the storyteller by adding to the importance of his task. So, you really no longer know, or to your knowledge never have known, who Tamar was? A Canaanite woman, simply a native, and in the first place, no more than that. But in the second place, Jacob's son's wife, daughter-in-law of Jehuda, Jacob's fourth, granddaughter-in-law, so to speak, of the man of the blessing. And in the third place, and finally, she was Jacob's devotee, and his pupil in knowledge of the world and of God, who hung on his lips and looked up into his solemn face with such reverent attention that the heart of the bereaved old man opened utterly to her in turn, and he was even just a little in love with her. For Tamar's nature was strangely mingled, in a way even hard and heavy to herself. With a part of her being, she was austere and full of spiritual striving, to which later on we must give an even stronger name. But in the other, gifted with the soul and body charm and mystery of Astarte. We know how receptive to such a combination a man can be, and to what advanced years when, like Jacob, he has always yielded to and dignified his own emotions. Since Joseph's death, or rather because of that lacerating event, which he seemed at first quite unable to accept, Jacob's personal majesty had only increased. Then, when once he got used to the fact, and his wrangling with God had worn itself out, the deity's cruel dispensation having at length worked its way into the mind so desperately shut against it, it became an enrichment of his life, an addition to its weight of history. By virtue of it, his musing, when he fell into a musing fit, grew more expressively, more completely, and picturesquely musing than ever, so that observers were seized with awe and whispered one another, "Lo, Israel muses on his tales." True it is, expression makes impression. The two have always gone together, and very likely the one has always had its eye on the other. That is nothing to laugh at, if the expression has behind it not mere humbug, but real life experience and a burden of tales. In such a case, the furthest we may go is a respectful smile. Tamar, the native girl, knew naught of even such a smile. She was profoundly impressed by Jacob's majesty directly she came in touch with him, and that had not come about merely through Judah, Leah's fourth, and his sons, two of whom she married, one after the other. All this we know, as well as the sinister and half-equivocal accompanying circumstances, in other words, the destruction of both Judah's sons. What is not known, since the chronicle passes it over, is Tamar's connection with Jacob, which, after all, is the indispensable premise of the whole episode, and a remarkable secondary action within our whole history, which we interpolate, while at the same time being aware that that history, which one may well call seductive, since it seduces us to such explicitness of detail, the history of Joseph and his brothers, is itself an interpolation in an epos incomparably vaster in scope. Tamar, the native girl, daughter of quite simple Baal farmers, moving within this episode of an episode, had she a notion of the fact? The answer is, quite certainly she had. Her own behavior, which was deadly serious, gallant and offensive both at once, is evidence of the fact. It is not for nothing that the word I used above, the word interpolation, keeps coming into my mind, as though it had a will of its own. Interpolation, insertion, pushing in, these form the motive of the hour. They were Tamar's watchword and mainspring. She was bent on pushing herself into the great history. And she did it, with amazing strength of purpose. It was the most spacious scene of which she had knowledge, and she would not at any price whatsoever be shut out of it. I think I also let fall the word seduction. There we have another key word, for it was by seduction that Tamar shoved herself into the great history of which this is an episode. She played the temptress and whored by the way, that she might not be shut out. She abased herself recklessly to be exalted. How did that come about?